This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, I'm Megan Wildhood, a host on New Books and Poetry, a part of the New Books Network. And I am so excited to have one of my pressmates here, who I'm going to be interviewing, Caitlin Cowan. And I am just going to introduce her, and then we're going to jump right into her latest collection, Happy Everything. So, Caitlin Cowan is the author of Happy Everything, forthcoming in February 2024 from Cornerstone Press. Caitlin holds a PhD in English from the University of North Texas, an MFA in creative writing from the New School, MBAs in English and creative writing from the University of Michigan. Caitlin has taught writing at UNT, Texas Woman's University, Interlochen Center for the Arts, and elsewhere. She works in arts nonprofit administration at Blue Lake Fine Arts Camp, where she serves as Director of International Programs and as Chair of Creative Writing. Caitlin also writes Pop Poetry, a weekly pop culture and poetry newsletter from Michigan's West Coast, where she lives with her fiance, their young daughter, and their two mischievous cats. Ah, yes, the mischievous cats. Thank you so much for joining me today, Caitlin. And I'm so excited to jump into this amazing collection, Happy Everything.
Thank you so much for having me, Megan. This is really exciting to talk to you about the book.
Yes. So I would love to jump right in here and talk about the inspiration for the book. I think readers, once you start reading the book, you might kind of get a flavor of that. But just to kind of give readers a taste of kind of what inspired this book and kind of how long you've been putting this together.
Yeah, that's a great question. Happy Everything is a book that was born from the wreckage, you might say, of one of my former lives. I like to say it's not a book about bad men and a bad marriage. It's not a book about the wedding industrial complex or mere misogyny. It's a book I wrote about the ways in which women are asked to facilitate pleasure, to be beautiful, and to participate in capitalism as joy. The speaker of these poems is a version of myself. She lets her husband win at Jeopardy. She smashes her wedding china in the street. She keeps celebrating her birthday, but nothing ever changes. And sometimes she's Jeannie of I Dream of Jeannie, who and fantasizing about, you know, shattering her pink bottle. But she sees herself as part of this ancestral tradition of making oneself smaller to accommodate men. And this book is about what happens after that. The book was born from my creative dissertation that was written during my PhD program at the University of North Texas, during which time I was both married and divorced. And in addition to the kind of patriarchal nature of the marriage I was part of, I also found that my poetry professors, who were exclusively older white men, were averse to my subject matter, which was too domestic, is the kind of message that I interpreted or, you know, inferred, I guess, from those meetings I had with them. And so, you know, I've been working on this book in some ways since 2015, but it really started to take shape for me in 2018, a few years later, when I had to really ask myself 3 years out from graduating with my PhD, what the hell is this?
Oh my gosh, that is an amazing summary. I feel even more seen, as we were talking about slightly before the before getting on the recording. I, as someone who has also been through a divorce, as a woman having gone through a divorce, I felt incredibly seen by this book and validated in a way that I did not know that I had not been and needed to be. And I think that that's one plug. Any woman who's been through a divorce, even if you don't think poetry is your thing, you should read this book. And then this summary of like facilitating pleasure and capitalism as joy. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Mind blowing. Okay. yeah, this was a book I really needed and didn't know that I needed. So that is, that's something I know that sometimes as writers, we're not always sure what we're doing. Like you said, what the hell is this? And it's like, I'm so glad you did not give up and you answered that question. Because I'm one of those readers that really needed this work. And
that's so good to hear. Like, I don't want you to have needed this book because right? of the subject matter, but I am glad that you have it now.
Yes, I am too. I'm so glad. Just as it's one thing to hear, oh, I'm sorry, or hear condolences. Like when people hear that, you know, you've gone through a divorce, even as at a young, relatively young age. But it's another thing to have your experience realized without having to explain it.
And that's one of the things that was a little bit difficult for me in the PhD program is that I was starting to look around at this subject matter even before the divorce happened. I actually wrote one of the poems in the book, Instructions for Divorce, shortly after I got married. And everyone in my program was like, are you okay? And I said, yeah, why? You know, not thinking anything of it. And I started to get deeper and deeper into the subject matter. And then my marriage did fall apart. And then I was bringing these poems to my professors. And they too are saying, you know, I don't think this is it. This isn't, you have to think differently, think harder. The subject matter, okay, but what else? What else? What else? They kept asking what else. And I mean, I think it was formative for me to look around and see, oh, this is not really just merely about patriarchy and marriage. It's a much larger problem.
Yes. Yes. That's one of the things I loved about this collection is it weaves in so many things. Like it's not, the summary would not be appropriate. Like this is a poetry collection about divorce. Like, no, it's so much bigger. And not that divorce is not huge, because speaking as someone who has gone through one, it's very huge, but it also is, it doesn't stand alone. Like as big as divorce is, it unfortunately is part of a bigger problem. And one that I didn't quite expect the ways that you've named it and called it out. There are definitely some obvious like, oh, well, you know, adultery is one thing, or we didn't love each other anymore, or those things. It's like, no, it's none of that. There's this systemic look at divorce that is like, you don't even say the word that much in the collection. So it's so brilliant. I want to jump into one of them from the poem, Happy Everything. There's a line that goes, her bad dreams are the sounds of no one in her kitchen. Neighbors potlucking on her rotten deck, silent and swirling their sangria, wishing its whirlpool would drown them. So there, in that one line, there's so, so much. And I kind of want to explore and hear your thoughts on what are the generators of these kinds of bad dreams? Because it's not just nightmares at night. It's like, these are things that people live. These are real scenarios.
Yeah. I mean, this poem, the title poem, and the title of the collection come from an actual nightmare that my mother had and told me about many years ago. And, you know, the fact that part of her terror was having to hostess so many events at the same time, or conversely, you know, my knowledge about how lonely her life can be. It's made me think a lot about the ways in which women seek community and what happens when that community disappears and the way that divorce impacts that. And yeah, I think that I love the line that you picked out. I mean, I love my own line. I love that you picked out that line. Wishing its whirlpool would drown them. I think there is something really sinister about some aspects of domesticity that appear, you know, multiple times throughout the collection. And I think that, you know, what the question for me is, well, what happens when a role like that evaporates? Or where do these expectations come from? Where do we learn how to throw a party? Who teaches us that as women? And for me, it was my mother. And where did she learn it? And that kind of question I try to answer by some of the intersection epigraphs that come from this really bizarro book that I love and have had in my home. And I don't know where it came from, but I've had it for many years. It's from Practical Cookery and the Etiquette and Service of the Table, a compilation of principles of cookery and recipes with suggestions for etiquette for various occasions, which is this 1930s American homemaking guide. And I think when I dipped into that book, I just started to feel, you know, oh, like this is just in our bones. This is in the bones of our culture. And it's comforting in some ways to just sink into that the way that I have in my life, to sink into the domesticity, into the femininity, and just let it envelop you. But then there's something really sinister about that, that I try to get at in that poem that you were quoting. Have I answered your question? Am I drowning in my whirlpool here?
No, I love it. I love that. I was going to ask about that, the interstitial or the different parts and where those quotes came from. I was like, this reminds me of Cotillion, which I'm not 40 years old yet. And I did Cotillion. I don't think I elected to do it. I didn't really fight my parents, but I was like, I could tell it was from a time long past, almost 100 years, but I was also like, and yet somehow this is also in my memory of which fork goes where and how to let a boy at this point lead in a dance, even if taller than him. And I was like, what does that have to do with anything? And just like it, yeah, it is so deeply ingrained, because I was like 14 when I did Cotillion. I mean, old enough to have my own opinions, but also like, oh, is this how, okay, this is how we're supposed to be women. Oh, all right. I've never seen this in my house. I've never seen my mother do any of this, but this is what we're supposed to do. Okay.
Right. I mean, part of your question about where do the bad dreams come from? Part of the question I tried to answer in this collection for myself was how did someone like me, who I like to think of myself as very independent, feminist, educated, how did even I become seduced by some of the ease of the, you know, the roles that we're asked to play in domestic spaces? How did even I succumb to this in a certain way? Or you know, when I was taking dance lessons for my wedding, my first marriage, we were taking dance lessons for the wedding. And this appears later in one of the poems after the party at the Bad Love Museum, the metaphor that the dance teacher kept giving us about, he's the frame and you're the painting. You know, that's what's happening here. You need to just let that happen. And just, you know, receiving these messages and going, okay, and just moving on with my life, as opposed to, you know, not thinking harder about it, but trying to square it more with my actual beliefs, rather than just participating in it, because that's what one does. So I guess those are my bad dreams now, or they were, and I've exercised them through writing this collection.
Yes. I think of, because this, the line, the reason this line grabbed me, I think, is because of this, as it was something that you said in your, in earlier in as part of the inspiration of how women seek community and how that sort of falls apart, or how divorce impacts that, and how there is, as you said, something sinister about domesticity and hosting parties. It's like, is that the way our mothers maybe sought community? And even though it kind of made them miserable, I'm getting the impression that most of the women in the boomer generation, that's at least my mom is in that generation.
Right, mine too.
Really did not like that, but that's what they were handed. It's like, this is how you have friends. And so they were like,
well, yeah,
we don't like this either, but here you go, daughters.
It's the place where you're allowed to have power. I mean, we can go all the way back to, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago, enclosure acts, like women not having a place in the public square and, you know, being pushed back into the home and saying, this is the only territory you have. The hearth is your public square. This is what you've got. And trying to make that work. And we do. I mean, I was great at throwing parties. I threw the best parties. I took such joy in it, or what felt like joy, or it felt like enough for a while, until the whole sort of project started to fall apart. But yeah, I mean, there is a really long historical line of what it means to derive power from your home and from your hearth. And it's political, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as you're saying this, I'm realizing, oh, the power in that, in like where the center of power is the home, is that is exclusionary for those who like, I'm like, I don't think I know how to throw a good party. I yeah. Like, I did cotillion. I know how to set the forks out. I just don't know where to get the forks. Like, where do you get tiny forks? Why is that even
I'm asking? Yeah, and it's only a source of quote unquote real power if you're able to reproduce the workforce, right? Like, yeah. To get super political, your center of power really only exists if you're able to give something back to the machine, which is to have children and be a mother. And that's, now you've got your power because you are, you know, contributing to the machine. And it's something I've thought about quite a bit. I thought about this a lot. I was reading Caliban and the Witch when I was at Hambidge, when I was working on the last iteration of this manuscript, the Silvia Federici book, just about the history of witchcraft and the history of women and their relationship to capitalism and their crucial part that they play in capitalism and always have, but the ways in which they've been, you know, manipulated and controlled because of the power that they actually have, and obscuring the sources of their power and all that kind of stuff. It's just a really, really fascinating book. And that actually informs my next manuscript that I'm working on a lot more, the witchcraft element. But yeah, it's something I think about quite a bit. And I still like to throw parties, but they feel different now.
Yeah, you're right. It's, yeah, because it's one thing to have been handed the source of power and kind of another thing to own it and make it yours, even as it's morphed from a source of deep, longstanding oppression in ways that we don't even understand now. But we expect, like, I don't expect men to throw good parties. I don't expect men to throw parties at all. But like, when there's a party, I'm like, oh yeah, probably like my friend is hosting it. It's a woman hosting it.
Yeah.
If it's the Super Bowl, then there doesn't really have to be there's no expectation for that kind of party. Just
yeah. I mean, and the thing that really ended up informing my thinking about this with the divorce that I went through was that I began to, you know, and again, this book it's drawn from my life. It is not a facsimile of my exact life, but inspiration wise, you know, I think about Maggie Smith's recent new memoir, You Can Make This Place Beautiful. And she says it's at one point in there that her literary career was taking off and she realized that she was needed back at her post, that her husband, there was this essential conflict between who she was as an artist and who she was in her home. And when she one started to eclipse the other, everything fell apart. And I began to realize in my own marriage that the more I didn't think it really mattered if I hosted these parties or I was this kind of wife or that kind of wife. But the more I tried to be my own self, the less able and interested my partner was in relating to me. And so it's a familiar and sad story, really.
That is the part that made me feel the most seen, was how is it that I ended up in a covenant, a sacred covenant, with a person who liked me less the more authentic I was.
Correct.
And where did I learn that that was okay? And where did I learn that any and all of the red flags that I did see them before. It wasn't like looking back, I saw them. I was like, no, I saw this. Where did I learn that that was acceptable? And right. Then it was like, oh, I don't actually have power over this. And there isn't going to be someone who would actually love me better. That's not where the power is at all. I didn't quite think of it in terms of power, but now looking back, it's like, it's that sort of way of relating to the word love, which is, that's not what that word actually means, but it's like that comes from the longstanding lesson of where power is.
And that lesson you're talking about, that is what ultimately helped me feel like, okay, there is a through line to all these poems I've been also writing about my family.
Yes.
Because that's where some of it comes from. That's where the lessons start, I think. And it was shocking for me to just wake up and realize that I had intuited so much from my family, thinking that I had learned better already, but I hadn't quite. Maybe now I have, or maybe now I'm a little farther down the road, but yeah, the impact of, you know, my upbringing is definitely a bearing on this book too.
Yes. That's there was so much, especially the talk about the father daughter relationship. There's a line here, and I'm finding, from my father drives to Muskegon. I'm probably not saying that right. With a bouquet.
You said it perfectly.
With a bouquet of flowers, though I will not see my father again, I will look for him in other men. Will let his absence flood me like cold water. This line grabbed me because a lot of times we think women who go through divorce had like physically abusive fathers or angry fathers or actively bad fathers. And this line about absence is like, that's what happened to me. I mean, my father did not physically leave. He's still alive. My parents are still married 50 years, but there was no emotional connection, really. Mm-hmm. And it was like, that does feel like cold water. Yep. And like shrink wrap in emotional isolation. So, this line prompts me to ask, like, so talk about the like father-daughter relationship and the impact on this, on the speaker's life and on the collection, as it sort of unfolded.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, my younger life was definitely characterized by just like an absence. Like you said, my father, was a part of my life until I was about 12. And my parents divorced, a very acrimonious divorce. But even prior to that point, he worked all the time. He just worked all the time. I have so few memories of him, really. He's a neuropsychologist, and the memories I do have of him are very colored by the kind of work that he did. And the dimension of his work really did impact the divorce and its aftermath too, because my perspectives on marriage and caretaking, I've, you know, started to understand, have been heavily influenced by both my mother's disability and my father's insistence that she was fabricating her illness, which was a part of our lives when they were splitting up. And it's a part of the book too. So I ended up being raised by my mother, who was basically a single parent from that point onward. And my father continues to work with people with traumatic brain injuries. And one of my strongest childhood memories is him describing what it meant to malinger, or to make up your symptoms, or make up your pain, or exaggerate your pain. And I end up asking that question, like, am I making up my pain, in Happy Father's Day, one of the poems in the book. And so my, just starting to question my own reportage of the truth, wondering to what extent caretaking is involved in marriage, and what is a healthy amount and what is an unhealthy amount, and what is normal, or what was, you know, the caretaking level due to my mother's illness. In what ways did I take care of my ex-husband? In what ways was he looking for that? In what ways are all men looking for caretakers? And why are we so great at it and so ready for it? Those are the kinds of familial through lines that informed that relationship that kind of undergirds the book.
Yes. Yes. That, I think I was picking up the undercurrent of it. Oh, so it wasn't just my ex-husband. There are really, is it all men? And where did they learn that that was okay to seek that? Totally unconsciously. I'm sure most men are not actively forefront of their mind looking for that. But why are we so good at it? Why are we so ready to jump into that role? Even when I am like, yeah, as an oldest child, I don't really want to be caretaking everything anymore. I would really like there to be space for others to take care of stuff sometimes, and or for stuff to just not get done and it be okay. Like, it doesn't, the world's not going to fall apart. And yet I feel compelled still to jump in. Where does that come from? Because it's really, like, it's probably related to the power question we were talking about before. But there is that deep compulsion. Like, there's this joke that, like, oh, men just want to fix. And it's like, I think that's only half the picture, actually.
Yeah, I think the pandemic really reminded us all of something we already know, which is how much unpaid labor women do, and how much our society revolves around the caretaking that they do and the homemaking that they do. And if they do not do it, things get very bad. Women, you know, left the workforce en masse during the pandemic because somebody had to take care, and that somebody is just almost always women. And it's 2023, you know, it's not 1930. And which is not to say that caretaking is not a valuable task. I have a 9-month-old daughter. I love taking care of her. I am not preaching against caretaking, but I think that it is such a much more necessary and complex position in society than we generally allow for.
Totally. And yeah, and speaking of that, like, I think there, most women might be able to recognize just the tiredness that comes from the constant expectation of caregiving, that whether it's a child, whether it's a sick person, whether it's an elderly parent, it's the expectation of caregiving usually falls, if there is a woman for it to fall on, it will fall on the woman.
Right. Yeah. And that kind of, that indignation is that's sort of where I started the poem, self-portrait as my yard reaction. That's where that began for me.
Yeah.
That sense of, if there is a woman to answer this question, I had better find her, no matter what she's doing.
Yes. Yes. And speaking of this, like, compulsion, there seems to be also this compulsion, or draw, maybe is a better word, to to love, what we think love is. There's in this in part three of the after 18 months of marriage, that's the title of the poem. Part three says, "I noose the top pearl of my best friend's ivory gown with its tully lift and lift her above herself. Sorry, alabaster bird, little darling. She will leave him in 26 days. And somehow I already know." I was like, I've had an experience like that too. And yet we're so drawn to love. It's not just, like, I don't think it's just weddings that we're drawn to. Weddings are actually kind of stressful in my experience, but we're so drawn to love, and that, like, we keep seeking it even after, like, I mean, divorce is devastating, whether it was messy or not. I think, not to downplay super messy divorces, mine fortunately was not terribly, but what is it that, why do you think we're so drawn to love even in this historical relationship of subservience that women have had to men? What is it that keeps us going after what we think?
I think love is it's everything. It's that's the good stuff. It's not love that I'm objecting to. I just finished reading Fleischman Is in Trouble. Are you familiar with this novel?
Yes.
And there's a part in the novel where one of the characters says, you know, I think marriage is, it's like that quote about democracy. It's the worst form of government, except for all the other ones. You know, that marriage and monogamy, it's terrible, but it's the best of all the other things we have tried. And I think that in that poem too, when I say I keep going, I love and I'm loved again, wary as a feral cat that comes inside. I'm, you know, to the extent that this is autobiographical, which it is in many ways. I mean, I'm engaged to be married again on September 30th of this year.
Congratulations.
And thank you. I mean, I anteed up again, and I intend to continue to ante up. I think that love is not the problem. It is the systems that we've devised that are supposed to create or contain or facilitate love that actually just perpetuate a society in which men have all their needs met and women exchange some of their power for a little safety. I don't know. Is that it? I am figuring this out day by day. I don't know. Love is everything. I think that that's actually what we need more of. We need less capitalism. We need less inequality in relationships. And if you are in a relationship where you truly privilege equality, that's all you need. Mm. There's plenty of room for love there.
Yeah, because that, what else could allow love to flourish, really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking of weddings, there's this line from the poem "Happy Anniversary" that says, "Outside, I fingered pennies for the wrong wedding, a final fixture to hide behind." I have so many questions about this line because it's so, so good. First, did you write this when you had, like, the timeline of these poems is, are you writing them in general and specifically this one when you'd met your current fiance, or is this all before and you're just like, this was just wrong and I don't know that there's ever going to be a right wedding?
A good question. My first draft of this poem, it's old. I could look it up. I began writing it in 2014, which I know because that was the year I was married and I was working at a high-end steakhouse in the town where I went to grad school to make some extra money for this lavish wedding I would end up having. And it was just a very bizarre experience. in food service. I was hosting there. So I definitely started writing it prior to ever being divorced, as many of these poems were written. The ending has been harder for me to stick, and the ending of this one has changed. I think that many of these poems have, you know, they've been with me for so long. Some of them, there is a poem in there that's from 2010. I think there's at least one. And I've just been living with it, refining it. Some of these poems just live with me and live with me, and I work on them and work on them. And I think in some ways they're not done because I don't have it figured out yet. I don't know what the poem really, I'm not listening to what the poem is trying to tell me, or it's not finished because not that every poem has one final meaning, but that I haven't fully understood what the part of me that wrote that poem was trying to say. Maybe I'll say that. And this one definitely, I never felt like I stuck the landing until I got to the line that's there now. Because I was just, the image has been the same, lighting up a cigarette in my former life as a smoker. What is worse, like smoking and working food service is just, it's not good. But I would hide out there. And I started to think about what else I was hiding or hiding from, and what was the thing I was hiding behind. And then behind is the refrain word in this guzzle, the form of the poem. And so thinking about how, I mean, of course, when you pick a refrain word, you have to commit to landing on it. And so it really ended up informing my my thinking about the hiding and the way that other people in the poem are hiding, the sort of patrons of this swanky restaurant. And what are we all hiding from as we get drunk on tequila after work, after our shift is over? What are we all hiding behind? What was I hiding behind at the end of the poem?
Yes, that, I mean, I could feel that, like, behind the restaurant in the dark with the sick, like, I could feel that. Even as I've never worked in food service, but and I haven't been a smoker, but I could just, like, somehow I was dropped right there. I was dropped.
That's
right
high there. Praise. That's because I can see it. I've spent years trying to see it. So that's really great. I'm glad you can see it.
I think part of it has to do maybe with the form. I don't mean to get too, like, esoteric on the listeners here, but there are so many forms of poems here. There's, like, prose poems, there's guzzles, there's all different kinds of the poems take many different forms of a variety, like a noticeable variety, which I love. And I wonder, it was that intentional, or did the poems kind of come to you that way, or how did you decide on the
That's
form?
A great question. I try to just really listen. I know it's, like, the most irritating thing in the world to hear a writer say, I don't know where the poems come from, man, but I do really try to listen to the, you know, the words that are coming to me, to the, I hate to say the voices that are coming to me because it implies certain things, but I try to listen when I'm hearing something in my head. And sometimes I just feel what the form is. I do love prose poems. There's tons of prose poems in here. I just adore that form for so many reasons. I think it allows you to really do what poets do best, which is focus on image and, you know, atmosphere and to make allusions, but it also gives you more real estate and it allows you to focus a little more on narrative without actually writing a story. And I mean, there are a variety of forms too, just because I think I've grown with this book so much and I've had it with me for so long that I've learned, I've become more comfortable with different kinds of forms, but also there is something, I like how heterogeneous it feels because it does feel like a party, kind of, just like a bouquet of flowers. Like, whoa, happy everything. Look at all this crap. Because that's kind of how, you know, it feels. You know, you've got a box of wedding gifts that you have to return. Like, whoa, look at all this junk. Look at all this stuff. And look how the same, you know, ideas fit differently or feel different in different forms. And you get to see different aspects of them, like turning, like when you turn a gemstone, you see different facets, different pieces of it. I'm glad that it feels noticeable in that way, because it feels kind of like a, expensive junk drawer or something.
Yes, I loved it. And I think, I mean, partly I am a poet, but I think there was just this, it did fit. It was happy everything. It was variety everything. It was, and that is also form follows function, right? So it was like, yep, everything is impacted in a divorce. Yep, it's everything, all the things, all the forms. There's no place that you can hide. It comes out in this form. It comes out in this form. It comes out in this form. And I think I was, and I don't know if people who have not gone through a divorce would have picked up on that, but I sure did. And I appreciated, like, yep, this does touch every aspect of your life. Even if it's not a particularly messy, long, drawn out process. Mine, praise God, was not, but still, yeah, I'm still finding ways that it's touched. Like, I'm like, oh, it's been 4 years and that fixture of a previous life is still there.
Yeah. So, thank you for that reading. That's so astute. I really like that. It does. I mean, yeah, it touches everything, and using different forms like that kind of proved it to me in some ways, but it also gave me different tools to examine it in different ways, which I was grateful for.
Yes. Yes. The gem and having it, reflect different facets. I mean, I haven't come across a collection like that where it's, I mean, you think it's one topic, it's really totally not. There's the poem Half Past, which is that focuses on the neuropsychologist that your father had as a career. It's just like, yeah, the bilateral neglect or unilateral neglect, that is so fascinating.
It really is. It's a really interesting language to have grown up with, to know about and to have known about from a young age. I mean, when I realized I was kind of writing a book about this topic, I wanted to make sure that it wasn't just a book about how somebody hurt somebody else, because those books are everywhere. And I think that I felt that I had more to say about it than that. And so I tried to really look at my life and find out what my languages were. And I was surprised to recall how much that impacted my life as a young person. Yeah. That sort of language of psychology.
For sure. I mean, that
both of my parents actually had a background. My mother and father met and in anthropology class at Michigan State University in the 70s, they were both psychology majors. And he went on to get his PhD, and she was supposed to also earn hers, but she became ill and that did not happen for her. So they both had this background, this footing in psychology that kind of colored my adolescence in a weird way that ultimately ended up being interesting for poetry, at least.
It seemed like, I was like, yeah, this, there's a deep knowing here, even as, okay, so you're not a neuropsychologist, but there was a familiarity with this language, that seemed kind of like it went pretty deep. I just, that the poem Half Past, I really appreciate, because, where it's talking about, either people who have experienced like stroke or head trauma, and they have this, where they only draw half of a clock, or they only draw, like they draw all the numbers, but it's only on one side, or they only eat from half of their plate, and it's not, forgetting, it's actually ignoring. And I was like, when I read that, there it's italicized in the poem, and I read that and I was like, I think my marriage was unilateral neglect.
Oh, it's, wow. Not, yeah.
It's ignoring both sides. It wasn't just, oh, I'm accusing my ex of doing that to me. I was like, no, I think it was both sides were one-sided. And
yeah,
hadn't thought,
I mean,
about
that's it. That's why poet, I mean, psychology is endlessly fascinating to me, and there's a part of me that thought that I too would go into that. But that's why poetry ultimately for me is my preferred way of knowing, because I can take what I know about psychology and I can marry that to images and to metaphors. And that makes ultimately more sense to me even than what a textbook is saying about the way the brain works. That's such a fascinating jumping off point, but where I take those kinds of things, that's how I make sense of things, I think. I think that's really smart what you were saying about, you know, using that distinction between, I think there's no malice when you have neglect, like unilateral neglect like that, or when there's aphasia, there's no malice in head trauma. It's just, right, there's something just not there. It's just not there.
Right. Right.
The other side of the clock is not there. I don't hate the left side of the clock. It's not there.
It's just not
and
there.
And so that became a productive way for me of seeing the way that two people can understand a divorce.
Yeah.
That not that there are two sides to every story, but that there's one side to every story and the other side does not exist.
Yes. Yes. I think that when I was, you know, cause I think there are things in our lives that happen that are so big. We process them kind of here and there periodically, even when we've moved on, even when there's no more anger, there's no more bitterness, there's still this, oh, now I understand this in a different way. Divorce is one of those huge things. And I really appreciated that language of unilateral neglect. And it's not forgetting, it's just that it isn't there. It's just not there. And it's like, yeah, there doesn't have to be malice. And that's helping me understand, like, there was a thing that is supposed to be between two people in a marriage that just wasn't there.
And I mean, that kind of thinking helped me. I realized a long time ago, if I was going to really write this book the way I wanted to, that I would have to eventually come to a place where I could write a poem like I Am Because We Were, which tries to really just be as fair as possible, to be as generous as possible to the other party, to look at something from a different angle and see what I could see, to see it from the other side as far as anybody can, which is not very much, you can try, but to, you know, do it without malice.
Yes. Yes.
To look at the poem, the poem starts out like, this is the one where I try to be generous. And it felt contrived as I started, but it really went somewhere for me. It was nice to look at it in a way to give myself not only formal exercises with different forms, but to give myself exercises and points of view too.
Yes, this is bringing up a question for me. From the poem March Madness as Memorabilia.
Yeah.
This one was a hoot. I loved to make you happy. You didn't return the favor. The books I stacked on your nightstand were frosted with dust. You snoozed through readings from the cheap seats, while my spit anointed the mic. Your games meant more than my poems. Your games meant more than me. When I read that, I didn't hear accusation. I didn't hear blame. I didn't hear anger. I just heard, this is what happened. So is writing, and I don't mean this in a trivializing way, but is writing in some ways therapeutic for you?
I think so. We like to talk about that all the time, right? That writing is therapeutic, and that by getting it out, by aestheticizing your experience, you're distancing yourself from it, you're taking it out of your body, you're examining it arm's length. And that's all true. It's all true. I fully believe that it's true. And I know that there are things, you know, that I've experienced that are difficult or feel traumatic to me, that I know when I finally do write about that, I will feel better. I can sense that. But in a certain sense, I think too that you are leaving a little bit of it there always. You're leaving a little bit of the original sort of pain that drove you to the page there. And I think it's there. I think it's accessible. Maybe if you want it to be. It's interesting because some of these poems are quite old now. And the place I am at in my life is so, so different.
Mm-hmm.
Head to tail different. It's now that I'm starting to do publicity for this book, it's really interesting to have to back in and think about these things and revisit these experiences. And it doesn't feel inundating, but it definitely, I'm able to sort of drop in through the poems to the state of mind that put me to the page, I think. And the writing absolutely is therapeutic, but I don't think therapy is necessarily about exorcising the pain, mm-hmm. nor is writing. I think it's just about making it highly tolerable. And if you're lucky, making it into something you can be a little proud of that you've made.
Yes. Yes. And I think one of the things that, at least one of the ways I find that I can be proud of my writing is when it has helped someone else, when it has
definitely
made someone yeah. else, when it has brought someone else to that place of, oh, I can process this in a different way. There's less anger. There's less pain. There's more understanding. There's more, as yeah. you say, fairness, because that was a goal for me too. Like, I can't have this fist shaking for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Person who is also human, because as you say, this line from The Marriage Bed, we humans are excellent at hurting each other. You and I are two such scholars capable of limitless pain. And it's like, it was both. As much as I can say I was hurt by this, that my ex did, he has the same yep. list. And yep. it's like, we are just good at hurting each other.
Yeah.
Why do you think we're so good at that?
Why are we so good? I don't know. Maybe, excuse me, maybe not everybody is. I was better at it than I wanted to be, you know?
Yep.
I think love makes you better at it. I mean, when somebody cuts you off in the road, you're like, hey, buddy.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have a lot of ammunition, jerk.
Right.
But when someone you love is cruel to you, I mean, you've got some really sick ammunition if you want it, you know? I mean, you know what these intimate parts of people, you know what their insecurities are, you know how in ways in which they've disappointed you and ways in which they're embarrassed and what their childhood was like. And it's just like a manual for how to hurt the other person if you want to.
Yes.
If you choose to. That's what vulnerability is. It's just totally exposing yourself and saying, here's all my shit.
Right.
Please don't use it against me. And then sometimes we do.
Right.
And
we have no control.
Yep. I mean, you ask if writing is therapeutic. I mean, it is, but you could argue that by writing a poem about something that was painful, you're kind of making a little, not a monument to it, but like a little headstone for something. And if you wanted to truly forget it, perhaps you wouldn't write it. But that's why poets are, we're weirdos, because we want to revisit. We want to revisit these little moments. I mean, if I had to live it, if I had to go through it, damn, I better at least get a poem out of it.
Right. Oh, I love it. There are so many more questions I could ask you, but a little headstone to close. Well, first, I want to ask you: is there anything that I didn't ask you that you wish I would have?
That's a great question. Oh, maybe I always wonder what folks make of the registry poems, the like object poems.
Yes.
If you had any questions about those, because I had fun writing them. I think they're weird. I just wonder how they feel to an outsider who is not me working on this book for a decade.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yes. So I, as a whole, I think the first one, I was like, oh, it's a list. Oh, and then I got it. I was like, oh, that's what's going on here. And so I, as someone who's gone through that process of, we have to pick out stuff that we want other people to buy for us because other people are going to buy things for us anyway, and we can't just say no thanks because people are going to buy stuff anyway, so we might as well not waste money. It just made me, I mean, all the capitalism questions came up of like, why do we do this? I get it. People want to send the happy couple off and they into their new life all set up. And then it's just, it just brought me, like, I don't know if you had a similar experience where it's like, why do we have to, like, do we have three toasters. Do we really need another one? Should we get a new one? Or, I mean, how old is that? The ones that we somehow have three of together. And it's just like these weird questions that, and conversations that you have with your partner. And I would remember we would get in stupid fights. Just because, and it was actually because neither of us cared enough, but we had to, we felt we had to do it. I mean, I don't know if you, how, because, you know, beginning in the framing of like capitalism is joy. It's like, that's where my mind went when the registry poems.
Yeah.
Came.
I mean the, and then for me, I mean, I spent longer, reckoning with what to do with that stuff than I did actually facilitating the legal dissolution of my marriage. The stuff lingered and I developed these, I was weird. I realized I had this bizarre fetishizing relationship with these objects that I didn't even like and didn't want.
Yes.
Which I finally was able to realize that there are so many aspects of the marriage were things that I did not ask for nor want. But it was a very weird period having these deep relationships with these objects that are now, you know, mainly gone from my life. I still have the crumb sweeper. Gotta hang on to the crumb sweeper.
Oh my gosh, yes, from the poem, yes.
But it's a weird place to be, to realize that, you know, your family now has feelings about what you do with these objects. And the emotional baggage that comes with that, it really just got me thinking about, you know, the ways in which the avenues that are and are not available to women in the aftermath of divorce and in the joy of marriage, that the way that objects end up becoming this way of relating to others and to your loved ones. And it's just, it's not good for us. It's not good for us. It wasn't good for me, I'll say, to have objects in my life that had that much power. But then looking at the objects and looking deep into it and seeing so many things that were so many layers that I was surprised. I hope the poems get close to that. They're prose poems, these poems that are registry poems, because there's so much to say. To look at a piece of Kate Spade Wedding China and then to have to reckon with Kate Spade's suicide as the aftermath of this is happening, and to think about what her empire stood for, and you know, there's just so much there. There was more than I was expecting as I wrote these little poems about champagne flutes and stuff like that. But I am glad that I looked really hard at them, even though it was bewildering to do it. Yeah.
Yes. I'm so grateful for that. I had a similar experience and I thought I was doing it wrong. I was like, why does this matter? This was even an object we fought about whether or not to put on the registry. And of course, I somehow ended up with it. And
yeah, of course. I mean, my mother and I had very serious arguments about Waterford crystal champagne flutes that I never wanted. And then they had to be in my home. They had to be in my possession. I had to keep them even after a divorce. And that kind of moment really just made my poetry sense tingle and say, hello, this is not about a champagne flute. It's about some other things that you can find out about if you sit down to write about it. But in the context of this argument, not about the champagne flutes.
Oh my gosh, I love it. Yes, that. And that is where capitalism intrudes. There's serious arguments that disrupt relationships about objects that are not wanted by the person who must keep them.
Rituals, clothing, objects. The language that we use to talk about marriage and divorce.
Yeah.
the requirement, at least at that time, at least in my part of Texas, to say, to utter the words, "My marriage is destroyed," in a courtroom. It's weird. There are so many ways that we go about this business, this commodification of romantic love, and then we wonder why it's not working for folks. I hope that I've touched on some things in this collection that feel larger than the politics between just two people, because
yes,
it felt like quite a bit more than that to me the longer I lived it, certainly.
Totally. I think that's another way I felt totally seen too, is like, okay, this was on some level a very private experience between me and another person. No divorce is the same, just as no marriage is the same. And yet there were so many things in here that I was like, I lived that. Oh, I had that experience too. Just even the feeling that I read between the speaker and the ex, I was like, was my ex this person also? Because I kind of feel like maybe it just felt so, I don't even want to say parallel. It just felt like, it felt so the same, which is how I know it was like, this is actually a universal vein that has been tapped.
And again, I don't want it to be universal, but I've been writing poetry seriously since I was just a kid, and I've wanted to be an author for a very long time, not because it is fame or money making. Certainly if it were, I probably wouldn't have selected poetry. Poetry selected me.
Right.
But it's, you know, and I've been chided for the kind of naivete of thinking like this, but I truly started writing because I felt seen when I would be in a bookstore as a kid. I felt like these authors were seeing me, and to have finally, you know, the opportunity to make someone feel seen by what I'm writing, that's all I could ever really ask for.
Yes. Another way that I totally relate. So to close, I would love for you to share from the collection Happy Everything, the poem Best Order.
I would be delighted to. Thank you for asking about this poem. It's one of the older ones in the book. It won the Literal Press Poetry Prize several years back. Judy Halebski selected it to win.
Oh, wow.
And it was printed as a beautiful broadside that I love and cherish, except that it was printed under my married name at the time.
Oh, no.
And so now it is this, and now it is another apocryphal object in my home.
Oh, no.
I love this poem, and having it in the book is a great way to sort of reclaim it and recenter it for myself.
Yes. Love it.
This is Best Order. A teacher once told me to hold a ruler like a razor beneath my sentences, up to the jugular, a threat to make them stranger, to see them for the first time again and again, so I might find the flaws and fix. As I look at you, as I have for most of the last decade, through the bottom of my glass, through a bedsheet of smoke, I understand. We must make each other strange again each day. Even as the prying stars peer in through the Venetians, we must blind ourselves to that starshine of sameness so we might see, vex ourselves once more to venture a straighter line, a sentence that stabs and is kind.
Yes, yes. I read the collection twice, and then this is the third time getting into this poem, and it's just so, it's deeper, richer every time. Thank you so much, Caitlin, for joining me today. And for listeners, you will be able to find the link to Caitlin's website, Caitlin's work, and the book Happy Everything, which you've just spent the last hour and only scratched the surface talking about. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Megan. Thank you for reading this book. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, thank you so much.